Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by S&C coach for Arete Performance, Tom Farrow. What does creative play mean to you? Learning is so important because we need to acquire knowledge so that we can implement that and start developing. However, learning is so much more than just memorizing information. We need to ask lots of different questions so then we can get our hands dirty by lots of different types of trial and error to not only retain information, but acquire new knowledge that we can apply in our respective fields. In this episode, Tom joins me because creativity is such an important topic for both of us, and we talk about how we implement this in education and strength and conditioning. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram and YouTube and check out all of our other content. Here is Tom Farrow. Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, mate. Thank you very much for having me.
I know we spoke just before we came on the episode and started recording, but this is my selfish episode because I wanted to really talk about creativity and a lot of ideas that I'm really thinking about at the moment. And I'll provide a bit of context where I've been thinking about it a lot, because the more and more we develop the progress theory, I guess people in this industry would think it'd be part of the creator economy. And so because you've got the word creator, I automatically start thinking about creativity. But when I link that to creativity, like it could be good in creativity, but other parts it could be quite bad. And the reason being that a lot of the time when it comes to marketing, you're kind of following trends or you're chasing what's popular at the time. So if you're truly being creative, technically I always think that the audience comes last. You're creating something that's unique to you based on your likes, your experiences, all of that type of thing. But if you're creating something to get as much attention as possible, then that's almost reducing the amount of creativity. So I'm in this sort of weird struggle trying to understand the importance of creativity, especially in a world so dominated like by social media. And then with the books I'm reading, I'm thinking, right, who do I normally talk to when it comes to stuff around creativity? Right, it's Tom. Okay, cool. Tom, you're coming on the podcast, and that's when I sent you the message. So thank you so much for coming on.
It's my favorite thing to talk about as well. It's a very interesting idea to explore.
Mm. Do you want to give a bit of an intro to yourself for anyone that's...
Yeah, we'll do the intro and I'll whack the record about whatever. I'm a performance coach, worked in a number of different sports, probably mostly rugby and football the last 10 plus years. I've also a little bit of athletics. Canoeing was one of the more interesting ones. And then a lot of individual athletes from different sports. Director of Arete Performance. And that's a performance training company. So we work with individuals, teams, schools, and businesses, essentially helping them solve performance problems. So helping them to become the best versions of themselves as individuals and organizations, that largely centers around solving performance problems.
Yeah, but you use a lot of creativity in your ideas. I mean, it's a nice, I don't like using the word lens, but it's a good way of thinking about, okay, what are we trying to achieve? Like we're trying to achieve and solve performance problems. And that's very different from like, I'm coaching people to be better. So, okay, well, how do they get better problems?
Yeah.
You know, it's a different way of posing it, but I think it's a really important way.
That's how I've always thought. So I think what I was going to say following your introduction around creativity, and this is what would be good, I suppose, to expand on, is I think, you know, there's creativity within terms of towards a fixed point, towards solving a problem. And then there's creativity that's maybe more explorative. You know, the creative process is both of those. We need space for both. I think athletes need space for both. There's lots of problem solving within elite sport in terms of like the day-to-day structure. There's a lot of time spent on trying to solve the problem of playing as good as possible or beating the next team, you know, and breaking that down that's a creative thing to do as well. But there's not lots of time on like the explorative, creative side of sport once you become a professional athlete, which I always think is very interesting, because obviously when we're young and we're playing sport, it's all exploratory. And I think that that might be an important part of it, that there's a goal. And maybe sometimes the goal is just to explore, but we're still exploring something, right? We're exploring our ability within this sport. Or I think we think of creativity as this like wishy-washy type thing, but there's actually very, very few domains where it's ever going to be completely boundaryless. There's always something that we're within trying to solve or trying to do or trying to explore. We might be trying to explore a movement or our how we think, but it's always related to something I think we're trying to achieve. And the exploring between those two different sides of it is definitely something I'd like to talk about more.
Why do you think creativity in terms of elite sport is less than compared to youth sport? You know, at youth sport, we're trying to encourage people to...
Well, I don't think there's probably enough of it in youth sport either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's enough of that. I think in all organised sport, because of the nature of time pressures and then eventually as you come into professional sport, business pressures, like you're an entity and they need to, you know, they want to succeed, and that's part of the point of the team. And then that comes with pressures within the organisations to make things happen in certain time frames. And if they don't, like you see in football, the managers get very little time to be able to influence the culture and then the tactics and then everything else towards performance. They get very little time, so I don't think that creates an environment where there is the sense that you can be creative and have time to explore, because we need to achieve this and we need to achieve it by then. And I think that happens probably in youth sport, but maybe there's less pressure, there's obviously less performance pressure, so there may be some more space for it. When I think about real creativity in sport, it's like kids playing in the street and the creativity that comes out of that and the problems that come out of that, and then how they constantly change the frame of competition in order to suit play. The play and the play is often, that's the aim, is you know, we're here to play. We want to come out and have a good time. And if there's a big kid on the other team who's much better than, you know, every other kid on the pitch, then they're going to have less players on that team, because the point is to make it an actual genuine competition. So that, and then I think if you watch kids play and how they come up with games, that's the real insight into creativity and what creativity really is. I say, if I was trying to summarize, it would be like just the permission we give ourselves with how we solve the problems we're facing. You know, sometimes I find that people, you know, this is the problem we're solving and we always solve it like this, and this is what we do and this is what we have to go through. And actually what creativity is maybe sometimes is just going, but why do we do it like that? What's outside this wall here? And do we have to do it like this? And those sort of questions. Creativity is your different perspectives about how you can look at things and giving yourself permission to solve problems in a different way. And then linking that back to coaching is that's where I think there's this applied idea of creativity. Like, yes, but the coaching is to solve the problem, but there are many, many ways to solve many problems. And it's this constant process of like, right, I'm going to try this. And I've got this feedback loop of, is it giving me what I want? Okay, no, it's not quite giving me what I want. Right, well, maybe I'll try this then. And if you were to say a creative person, then maybe that creative person might be more open to assessing that feedback loop more frequently than someone who was less creative, if you're trying to define that in some way, although I'm not sure you can.
Do you think people who lack creativity often put up their own boundaries so they don't even start that feedback loop because they are comfortable at trying to solve things in a certain way? So then they're just sort of automatically or subconsciously stuck in that initial way of doing things. So then they can't have an opportunity to then figure stuff out through a feedback loop because they never actually get to it.
I think so, yeah. And I think that you know, there'd be a lot in personality traits that would lean towards creativity or creative type. Like if people were high in openness, going to be much higher in like that, or willingness to accept other ideas. Whereas people less so, a good book to mention would be Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And he talks within that, Robert Percy talks within that about quality. And essentially, look at that. Already. Are you in the middle of reading it now?
Yeah. I seem to have three or four books on the go, which is probably not a good thing. I'm also reading this book as well, which has really opened my eyes, Shop Class as Soulcraft by Matthew Crawford, which I'm sure will... Not touch that. Topics that they that he talks about. He's basically, so he did a philosophy PhD, joined a think tank, and then absolutely hated it, and then started up his own motorcycle repair shop.
Wow.
He had a history in motorcycle repair, electrician, electronics and that type of thing. But, you know, he's gone from something which is very sort of thinking based.
Yeah.
And thought, actually, we've separated thinking from doing and we're not appreciating doing. And it's really, really quite impressive. You know, even in the shop floor factories, you know, we separated the managers from the people working on the shop floor so that they are more efficient. They just do what they need to do to get more output. So there's less autonomy or thought process for the people that are, you know, utilizing their hands. And, you know, we've taken that away from people. And I think that's a problem. It's reduced creativity because you need to get your hands dirty in the problem to really truly understand it. So, yeah, it's an amazing book. I definitely recommend it.
The most defining factor about being human is how creative we are compared to any other species, essentially.
Hmm.
I don't know if you'd call it theological, but my philosophical ideas on it is maybe that's the point. People think about evolution as, you know, we evolved to procreate and that's what we did. We evolved just to further the species, and creativity sometimes thought of as this like spandrel, you know, spandrel, like the idea that it's just a side effect. And I actually wonder, maybe creativity is the point. Evolution is the tool of just becoming further and further creative in how we explore things. I'm glad you're reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, because you might help me remember the word, because I haven't read it for probably 12 to 15 years, but it had a massive influence on how I think, especially about this sort of stuff. And particularly in his dichotomy, because he talks about romantic quality, and then there's another word for the other type of quality that I can't remember, but I don't know if you're at that point.
I don't think I am.
But essentially you've got romantic, which would be like your classic idea of creativity. And then you've got maybe more like an engineering type quality. Type mind, the type quality and type process. So his whole thing is like, you know, there's beauty in the riding of the motorcycle, but there's also beauty in like the detail of how you maintain a motorcycle and those like fixed, almost like engineering type processes. I always think, especially we're not in the world of art as coaches, we're in the world of sport, but I think we think of artists and people within that world as like super creative, and some of them will be like that, but some of them will be very, very, very process driven as to how they create their art. And I think you see it the same in teams, and you'll see very creative, intuitive, almost like want to figure it out as they go athletes. And then you've got athletes that are, I need a plan. I do this, and I do that then, and I'm going to do that then. And this is my preparation. And then you've got these two sides of the continuum in teams, and they all have to work together to solve this problem, but they're very different types of personality. So that dichotomy that I first came across in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was really useful for me to help change my perspective on that and appreciate that how different people will see the world and how there's different ways to solve the problem, and there's beauty in all of it. This idea of creativity, I think, can be as much applied to the artful, creative, the classic idea as it can to, you know, this minute design or some piece of technology, you know, and how we do that. And that's all creative, I think. It's just different appetites for it, maybe. And then I'm linking back around to like the people in terms of like not being open to that feedback loop. There are definitely personalities who like to question why we do this, why are we doing this, why are we doing this, why are we doing this. There'd be personalities who would be more inclined to that, and people who are much more just let me carry on my process. This is my process, let me do my process. If I'm doing my process, everything's okay, the world is right. It's quite interesting from a coaching perspective, being in an environment, especially like, you know, if you're leading departments and stuff and that, and it's something I've definitely thought about when I've done that, is the different types of personalities and being aware that as a person who's going to ask why and probably look to change things because it seems like it's the right time to change things, you're going to particularly upset the people who really like their process. So you've got to be sensitive to the idea that they're seeing the problem differently to how you're seeing the problem, and I think that's something to consider in those environments as a coach.
Well, that nicely leads into my next question, because how would you change your approach when working someone that's very much process driven to someone that's more romantically creative driven? How differently do you work with those types of personalities? Because you've worked in elite sport for, well over 10 years now. So Has your approach to these athletes changed and really matured and got the best out of them?
Yeah, probably. I probably would be subtly different. I find the whole process of coaching such a personable thing. Like, it's very much I want to connect with the person regardless. I really enjoy that about coaching. I really enjoy trying to understand that person and figure out what it is that motivates them, that they're drawn to. What do they like doing? Why do they like it? I probably have to be more conscious in a way of when I'm working with more process-driven athletes in some ways, because I'm not that nature. I'm more of a, why are we doing this? I'm happy to walk in one day and it'd be one way, and walk in the next day and it can be another way, and I'll be fairly okay with that, because I'll just be like, right, well, as long as I know where we're trying to solve the problem to, I'm fairly open with how we get to that. But in other ways, I've clicked with those athletes as well, because one thing I like to do is talk about why. So if we're doing something, I wouldn't be like, we're just doing this, but this is why we're doing it. And I find that those process-driven athletes actually really want to know why. They want to orientate it within their process. So they really want to know why we're doing this. And as long as there's a why, then they get behind it really, really well. My experience in teams is sometimes that the more open athletes are the ones that I didn't connect with initially, but that's, like, even though that it made the most sense that we would connect, it's just that they're more like, okay, well, I don't really care about S&C. I don't care about all this stuff. I just care about playing the sport. So I'm not really going to invest much into you. But then actually after like years of working with teams, they're the athletes who I've become almost like close friends with, because you are very, once they realize that you see the world in a little bit of a different way to, right, we're just going to have to lift weights, and this is what lifting weights is about. It's about, well, no, we're trying to help you solve the problem of your sport. And then they obviously love that as well, because then that's their why. And it's just where you focus on the detail of it. You know, I find that with the more process driven, you would be talking more about the process end of it and the whys of that end. And I enjoy talking about that as well. Like, physiologically, why are we doing this? This is what we're looking to achieve. This is why we do this, pick this stimulus over another stimulus. But I also love talking about with the more open athletes. I'm like, you're on a pitch and there's a person in front of you. Like, what are you thinking? Why do you do that? And then they love going through that process of, well, oh yeah, this is why I think this, or this is what I'm seeing and stuff like that. And I love learning that from them, because they see the world differently. Like, their experience, and that's another interesting thing around coaching athletes, is I love talking about this idea of perception action coupling, and, you know, because of what that means. So this idea that basically what you see will be related to what you can physically do. So say if you're a really fast reactive athlete, the way you see the pitch and the world in front of you is different, because you've got more opportunities to use a wider vision than if you're a big 130 kilogram prop who's very good at going straight line, but not much outside of that. So trying to understand like how perspectives are so different with different athletes based on how they're made up and then how they see the world. So I love talking to athletes about that as well. Like,
certainly from a more personal, because how does your ability to create or develop creativity within these athletes, how can it develop if you don't know the athlete on a more personal level? And it sounds like over time that you've taken more time to try and figure it out, or at least let the athlete figure you out as well, so you can develop that relationship, and that's when you start to bring out the creative side of them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think just not forcing things is really important too.
Mm. Is there a particular athlete that you've always been particularly impressed by their creative nature?
There's a couple of standouts. I don't know if I should name people, but there's a couple of standouts in that there was players that I've worked with, and what was amazing was watching them in team talks, and you could see they were not listening to anything that being said. They're just in their own world. But then they'd get on the pitch and they'd just solve the problem in a way that was so amazing to watch. And it was partly that physically they had the ability to do that. But you see them literally almost like this, and then they'd be like, right, okay. And then they'd just play. And then they'd come away from the little huddle, the team talk, what are we doing now? Like, and then you just see the way that they're just the way their mind works. They don't feel like they're going to take in information that way, maybe. And they just know that, right, someone's going to explain, basically, they'll just get one of the other players to go, right, this is the rules. And they go, all right, cool. And then they just do it. And it's really cool to watch that, because you can see it happening. Like, just because obviously where we are as S&C coaches, you're usually just outside and sort of watch that from afar.
It's a really cool skill to have.
Yeah, I want to provide a little bit of structure, actually, just to almost, I think it's a good point in the episode to bring a little bit of structure, just in terms of, I want to go from this problem solving and then and then how I started to think and look at these different ways of balancing things. So I think what's really important in terms of coaching and what we're doing is balancing, and I'll often talk about like order and chaos and the yin yang for Arete. This, you know, we use this modified yin yang that we've got, the symbol for Arete. And the reason behind that came from this questioning why and questioning out. And I was working with a lot of different sports, and I was working with in rugby sevens, kayaking and athletics at the same time. And then alongside that, I was doing some one-to-one work and mostly PT, but also a little like with individual athletes and fighters as well, at that time, tennis players. I was thinking, what is the thing that connects all of these sports? Like, what connects all these athletes? And at the same time, I was reading around like mythology and storytelling and Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung and stuff like that, you know, the hero myth. And I thought, well, all of these athletes face the unknown and then they come back with something valuable, which would be a win if they win. You know, that's what they're doing. They're going to face the unknown over and over again. And I thought, okay, well, I wanted a framework of thinking that helped me go into these different environments and be able to solve the problem of what they're of that, almost like understand that environment. And that's why I looked to develop this framework of thinking. But I was like, so how do you get better at facing the unknown or facing chaos? Is where you have to face chaos. Like, you have to, otherwise you're never going to be able to deal with it when it shows up. And that's in the story form, is where the dragons and the knights fight the dragon and so on and so on. The reason though that they're displayed as dragons in the story form is because dragons can kill you. And I think in the way I sort of approach life in at that period, especially, I just said yes to everything, every opportunity that came my way from a coaching perspective. I said yes to all of it. And I was working stupidly long hours. I was riding a motorbike in between each of the different things. So even then, you've got to be switched on to not die. I mean, my wife was studying medicine. We had a one-year-old. It was a crazy, crazy time. By the end of that year, I was completely burnt out. So that gave me the really practical understanding of too much chaos can destroy you. That's when I started to realize you need this balance of order and chaos. So when I'm working with athletes, the first thing I'm trying to understand in each situation really is like, are they within order? Are they comfortable? Or are they in chaos? Are they uncomfortable? And then everything else is just a tool to affect that. We know if we're going to help them grow and develop, we need to expose them to things that they're uncomfortable with in some form. So that can be physical discomfort, which is basically the strength conditioning process. We're providing a physical stimulus that is slightly beyond what they've been exposed to before in order to make them stronger. And the same for speed, power, fitness, whatever. Or it might be tactical discomfort. Here's a tactical situation you haven't faced before, or technical. Yeah, and we can stress all those different parts of that. But we also, if we just leave them in this uncomfortable place, or it's too uncomfortable, it's too challenging, then they'll become completely demotivated to face the challenge. So then we need to understand, okay, what are the tools for order? And then as a coach, some of our tools for order would be like helping provide a solution, or simplifying the task, or giving them a framework of reference that's similar to what they've already done previously. And maybe tools for creating disorder would be like maybe more question as well. And then the task itself can be a question. So then it is a question. That's how I see what we're doing. We're asking questions of the body, or questions of the mind, or questions of their like tactical ability. That's the framework that I sort of work with. Like, okay, we're trying to solve the problem. Are they good at solving the problem? What level are they at solving the problem? Okay, how are we going to give enough chaos, enough discomfort, enough change in order to stimulate update? But are we conscious that we don't push them over an edge where they don't care about that anymore because it's just too hard, or just not, you know? And I think that's all we're doing at any level with any set of people.
That's a really cool framework to have. I think I remember when you were going through that period where, you know, you were working ridiculously long hours, your wife was studying for medicine. I'm sure I remember it because I remember how tired you were.
You would have seen me around St. Mary's with big bags in my eyes every now and again.
Yeah. But it's such a tough time like that. You kind of realized you were too much into chaos and had to pull yourself back, but it ended up being a really important learning period for you.
Like, I think most people you see, like, some people are more biased to, they need a bit of chaos, they need a bit of update in their life. And some people are biased towards order and structure, like we were saying. So I recognize through that process that I'm biased towards chaos, and I like variety, and I like change, and I like new problems to solve and new challenges to face. But I also realize that if I don't keep an eye, like keep some structure, keep some order, then I go too far and I won't be able to stay on top of all of it. So I finished the year like completely burnt out, and I had to stop doing a couple of the the team stuff, and then I just focused on sevens, which was almost like at that time the best balance of everything for me at the sport. So it worked pretty well like that.
I'm going to interrupt here because I wanted to share with you the Progress Theory newsletter. If you want the latest information and recommendations on how to optimize your physical and mental performance, then subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack today. Click the link in the show notes and subscribe to get the best information on human performance sent straight to your email. Now, back to the podcast. Do you feel people, even if they are naturally more inclined to be slightly more in order or slightly more in chaos, over time, that might change? So the reason that I'm asking that question is because I feel if you asked me this question in my early 20s, I probably would be in that slightly more on the order side. I love processes. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. It's almost like discipline was the key thing that really pushed me. If I just remained specific and disciplined over time, you know, I'd achieve what I want. And it did to a certain extent. But as I've got older and I guess my aims and my what I've wanted to achieve have changed, I've realized that was slightly limited to me and didn't really satisfy me. So it's almost like now, in terms, especially in terms of learning, say, I would say I'm more on the chaos side. I mean, there's like 15, 16 years apart, but it's interesting to think that whenever you talk about this, you think people just, it's their personality type. They're naturally more one than the other, and then they go through life, you know, solving problems based on those, that skill set. But the idea that that might change is something that's only really occurred to me when you were describing yourself in terms of chaos and order. So is that something you've noticed in other people as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's research in some ways that support that as well. If you look into personality traits, there'd be research that support people change. I think there's loads of reasons why people might change one way or the other, right? Like, you know, a significant event in your life, positive or negative, some sort of transcendent experience might send someone more into a life of service and order, but, or it might send someone into completely just look at things with more openness than they ever had before. If you look at a personality trait in terms of how that links even to like political leanings, and the idea is that people become more conservative as they age from a political standpoint, which makes sense in a survival perspective, because as the older you get, the less time you've got to correct any mistakes. So you become more conservative, and maybe where that comes from as well, that idea changing politics. But I would say I, in some ways, have become more orderly, certainly like stepping into more of the head of roles, the head of department roles. I knew there was a process I went through before doing it, thinking, I don't know if I'm going to be very comfortable doing this because it is such a challenge. And then, you know, the framing of it was, well, this is the real challenge, and this is what you have to be able to face, and then find the order that's suitable for me. But there's going to have to be order, it's going to have to be structure in what you're doing, because you're now managing and working with other people. So you can't just, you know, figure, you know, do, it's not all your own thing anymore. You have an impact on the wider process of the entire place. So I think I knew I had to inhabit more order in how I structured things and thought about things and communicated things. And I was very conscious of that. And I even, like within a department, I'm quite conscious about the balance of the department in terms of personalities. And that's partly because, like we said, interacting with athletes, there's very different types of athletes in a team from a personality perspective. And you would hope that there's someone within your department that each athlete at least feels somewhat connected to, that they can share what they need to share in order to help them become the best athlete they can be. The point is to help them become the best athlete they can be, especially in football teams where you've got a bit more budget to have bigger staff. I really thought about that in terms of, okay, this type of player is going to connect with this type of person, that type of player is going to connect with that person. And I think that was really important to me in terms of structuring a department.
There's a story about a successful US Ryder Cup team that originally they would pair people up for the pairs based on someone's got a very good drive game and the other's got a very good putting game, for example. You could tell I don't know much about golf. But instead of doing that, they didn't match up people's gameplay. They matched up people based on personality, and they had one of their best successful years so far. And it kind of links into what you were saying, like personality might be such a driving factor when deciding what to do. And if you don't have that in place beforehand, what you do after in terms of the problems that you solve in terms of leading towards performance might not be as effective if you haven't got the base of the right people in the right place based on personality and their creativity leanings, say.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that isn't often thought about because it doesn't really fit in a box, you know. And even within organizations, they try to make it fit in a box with, you know, personality tests. And I think they're quite interesting processes to go through. I've done them quite a lot of times. And I do think they're interesting processes to go through in terms of helping people just recognize, oh, okay, right. Some people need that, like, obvious. You think differently to me. That's, I think, the most valuable thing out of them. I don't think that when you then really get into the details of you're a type of this person, you're going to be, because it's not that. Everyone's personality is such a different wishy-washy mix of all these things. And it's just leanings and understandings. And ultimately, you've got to get beyond the boxes and the boundaries and just connect with someone on a personal level. Like, that's best for everyone. And I think the teams that really, really succeed seem to do that in a way that allows for that. It has a space that allows for that. And then over time, people really come to understand each other. The Sevens team, when I was there, was just such a brilliant mix of personalities, but it was a very ultimately loving and understanding environment. And that's what made it special. And that's what made the group of people special, in that everybody was invested in it being that way, even though you had the full spectrum of personalities across the team, but everybody understood each other, you know, and everyone understood what people liked. And with Sevens especially, you spend so much time with each other because you travel. And, you know, you spend long flights, you're away for two and a half weeks at a time, and you spend a lot of time with each other, which made it really special because it becomes this real shared journey, that's sort of the point of the whole thing. It's like, let's try and achieve something really, really cool together as a group. And in doing so, we're all going to change individually as people in order to achieve that great goal. And that's just part of our individual journeys, but we're deciding collectively we're going to do it all together. And that was something that took me a while to think about, like in sport, and in terms of going through this process of, like, you know, sometimes it's feeling a little bit corporate and going, what's the point of this? I don't want to just do a job. I dropped out of school and went and got a job in the city and then spent the rest of my life since then almost like running away from doing anything that felt like work. That sort of drove me to sport, and I was training. I was very interested in it. I'd almost been doing strength and conditioning since I was 14, or interested in it before it was even a thing. I didn't know it was a thing. I was just reading programs and Bruce Lee programs and Arnold Schwarzenegger programs and writing them for my friends and stuff like that, but and for myself. And then I went through this whole process of dropping out of school, going into the city, and working in the city, dropping out of that after a year and doing every other job under the sun. But then thinking, well, I really like sport, so let's do something in that. But when I get that corporate sense of it, we just do this because this is the, I really don't enjoy that. I enjoy the teams, the people, shared problem solving, that shared story. That's what I think makes sport really, really special.
Mm. Yeah, certainly. Develop that culture first. Culture comes first almost at times.
Yeah, like it takes so long to build. It takes so long to build. And I think the best teams, they understand what their beliefs. Every team that have a certain set of beliefs about themselves. The All Black believe they are the best rugby team in the world. And there's all this story around them and history around that. Anybody who goes into that understands that, you know, the boundary for what we're going to accept in terms of poor performances is actually very slim because we're the All Black. And I think great teams, they get to that point where their expectations of themselves are so high. So it's beliefs, expectations, and then standards. The beliefs almost set the expectation, and the expectations will set the standard, which is, you know, it's easy enough to say it that way around. But when you're in a team and you need to do that the other way around, you've got to create that. You know, they're not a team that performs. That's a different challenge, because then it's like, you know, you are going to have to change the standards and you're going to have to change the expectations. And then you can't force beliefs to change. They either, you know, they just do over time if the results come and things start being positive. And that's what I think is some of the great, great leaders obviously are able to do. But it's a very, very hard thing to do. In some ways, that's off the subject of creativity, because it's starting to get into like more of a fixed idea of performance. But then it's like, well, how are you going to approach that situation? If you start working with a team or a person, just understanding, okay, what are their beliefs? What are their expectations? You know, what are their standards for how they go about things? And then, you know, you can add that framework to it, like we were talking before about the different personality types. What's the personality type of the team? You know, and getting a sense of that. We're trying to influence the expectation and the standards, but within the context of their personality and what they care about. because otherwise it's just never going to fit. I think frameworks are a really interesting thing. It's something that I use a lot in my thinking and in my how I communicate what we do with Riverite in terms of our different models for speed and agility and contact skills and team sport conditioning. I've got frameworks for all of these things. So they're my little bit of structure. But then actually, you don't take the structure too seriously. It's just it's a tool. It's not the main thing. And the main thing is helping them be really great at their sport. And then that's, you're always trying to question, I suppose, back to that point.
Actually, that's a really nice segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask in terms of frameworks. And if I link that to S&C and how we apply the physical training to improve, I don't know, physical determinants of sporting performance. Quite often within S&C, we might have some form of tests to try and see or at least monitor how the athlete is progressing. However, some people might be uber critical and say that people end up training to get better at those tests rather than get better at training for the sport. And I think maybe if you're so focused on that test, it might put a load of constraints on what you do in terms of general training for that sport. So say, right, we need to get, you've got these three tests, we need to get better at them. So all of our S&C training is focused on getting better at those. You're constrained by that, so you don't then add creativity within the S&C training. What's your thoughts on in terms of testing within S&C? And do you think sometimes it can be a barrier that we put ourselves up to, and that actually minimizes or at least limits some creativity?
Any boundary we create or put up and don't realize that it's not a fixed thing, at some point it's going to constrain us in a negative way. You know what I mean? It's any boundary of anything is, there's no fixed boundaries. We create fixed boundaries because it helps us understand the world and helps us make sense of it. And in that sense, it's really important to do that, because otherwise we would be in complete chaos. We would have no ordering approach to get to where we want to go. Within a retail, I think we probably test more broadly and comprehensively than anywhere else I've spoke to in terms of just a general process. Our athlete summary would include 16 metrics of about 12 different areas of the body that we're looking at on our athlete summary page. And within each of them, we can go levels and levels and levels below. That doesn't even include like speed and stuff like that that we're looking into, or any of the mechanics of speed. Or they're really good little clues. They just give us little clues or further evidence into like why the athlete might move the way they do. But none of it is a fixed idea. I never come out of those going, I absolutely know you're this type of person. I think you're this type. And then I'm going to just sit with that idea and then compare it to how they move. And, you know, in terms of you taking something like acceleration, you might get really quad dominant or really posterior dominant athletes. So you might be, some people can be mixed, but so you might have those two sides of that dichotomy. That will probably change how they accelerate based on what they use and how they strike the floor, how much of their foot's going to be on the floor when they do it, and the cue that you're going to give them. So you can usually see that just from the acceleration, but the testing gives you quite a nice go, oh, okay, your body likes to produce force like this. It likes to solve the force problem like this. And therefore, we probably need to work with that rather than against it. So I think testing can give you like these really little clues and guides and points of direction. And it's a massive part of our process. But one of the things that I always think of it is, and I say to people, is like, but we don't take it too seriously. It's not, the test isn't the sport, and it never will be. And that's the reality of the whole situation, and whether the skill stress contact continuum for speed and agility that was built around the idea of recognizing that. I've seen athletes that solve the problem of their sport in terms of beating defenders. So what's in speed and agility is how we move around the field. In an attacking perspective, that's, can you create space for yourself? Can you create space for the team? In a defensive perspective is, can you take space away from the opponent as an individual? Or can you take space from the opponent as a team? Broadly, that's what you're trying to achieve. I've seen athletes that can solve that problem. So question number one, can they solve that problem? Yes. Then when I put them in something really basic, like an isometric strength test or, you know, hamstring, and they might be pissed weak. So you're like, well, that doesn't mean they can't solve the problem of the sport, but it might create some limitations at some point for certain aspects of speed and agility. And it's just trying to, I think the hard thing is trying to be able to zoom in and zoom out. There was a Hank, I went to a Hank Rational, I don't know if that's how you say his name, talk He's an athletic coach. And he said, coaching is about being able to see the trees through the forest and the forest through the trees. And I think that ability to zoom in and out, is something that I'm thinking about all the time. So the testing is something that is a massive part of our process, but you've always then got to realize it sits within this much wider boundary, wider framework of, you know, are they good at their sport? And I think that's where you see it. And athletes really disconnect from the idea of it is when they start getting judged by these tests, as if it defines them as an athlete. And I have conversations about this all the time, like almost weekly when we have new clients or come into a retail and when we talk, and they're so refreshed to hear that it doesn't need to be about, you know, the numbers, but the numbers are important. Here's why they can, this is where the numbers impact, but they're not the whole thing. They're just a part of the picture. There's a lot of environments that athletes, you know, and the testing is used as this stick to whack athletes over the head with, just for the sake of whacking them over the head with something, rather than going, okay, right, let's start with the problem. Are you solving the problem in your sport? Are you there? And if they're like one of them amazing at it, then you might not need to change too much. You can be a little bit less, actually, things are all right, I'm not going to change anything too significantly. But if they're like, no, you know, I'm not, you go, okay, well, you see this thing down here, that could influence up there. But Mark, should we focus on that for a little bit? Yeah, I'd be quite happy to do that. Okay, cool, let's do that. And then it becomes, again, a shared journey. But you're trying to, I think we're trying to help paint that picture. And I think role as coaches should be to understand and be able to communicate that story from this little minute prep exercise we're going to do for your calves down here to how to solve a problem on the pitch. And we say to all our coaches in a retail, it's like, you need to be able to solve that problem. You need to understand that problem so you can communicate that. And then everything has a point and everything has a purpose. And you're not just doing stuff. You're helping them along, understand that journey. So that's where like testing fits in for me. And with the tests as well, you know, we set up these tests and every single time I do a test, I am in some way testing the test. It, you know, I'm open to the possibility that it's not showing me what I might think it's showing me. And I put an article out the other day. I'll try and explain it a bit here, but the idea of it's like the horseshoe gospel, it's called. It comes from a comedian called Tommy Tiernan, who's a great example of creativity and how he approaches comedy and the wildness of it. And I love the wild. I think I'm drawn to that philosophically in him, the wildness of how he approaches it. And I suppose just quickly on that before we move on to the article idea, if you think of that as something like comedy, which is just like this intuitive thing, I love comedians and I love listening to them talk about their process and how they tell stories. And I always think, as a coach, if you could tell stories that well, what a powerful thing that would be to communicate ideas with that ability. He's been working on this show for about 3 months straight, working material, as all comedians do. And it's this amazing process of repetition in order to make something seem completely fluid, which is a really interesting idea about creativity. And we can probably link that back into sport eventually as well. But So the article is called The Horseshoe Gospel. They came from Tommy Tiernan. And the idea is that, I think he's got a podcast episode called that. And it's, he says, this podcast is horseshoe shaped because there's something missing. And essentially, I love this idea that you're not looking for fixed whole things. You know, you have these frameworks, you have these theories, you have these models, but you need to leave a little gap. So it's not completely closed off to the need to change. And that's how I'd approach the frameworks and approach all of these ideas and testing, is that we're doing a test because we believe it to give us a clue as to certain qualities of an athlete. But if something comes along that suggests we're not seeing that, then we might need to chuck the test out completely and do something different. And that might seem quite drastic, and it's probably very rare that anything happens that much, like bam. But the whole idea of the black swan, you know, everyone thought all swans were white until the black swan came along. And then that changes the dynamic completely. So sometimes one little piece of information can change the actual validity of an entire test and why you're doing it. So that's something I think you've always got to be open for with the test as well.
I see something similar, or maybe even worse, within education. So say, for example, you say you do a lot of testing to find clues. Well, if you look at a university degree and all the assessments that you do throughout that, that they doing something similar. They're trying to test you and your ability to what you've learned, but also to show what you're good at and what areas that you can improve on. If you took a step back, it just provides an overview of your skill set. Really, the end goal is where you want to go much later than university. The university is just one small part. But people place so much emphasis on, I guess, the grade of a particular assignment and stuff like that, where really the learning that you've got from preparing for that assessment is the important bit, not the grade. And then the feedback can just provide you with a bit more additional information for you to then build upon.
The thing with universities and any educational process is if there's going to be an evaluation at the end, which there should be, otherwise it's very hard to determine like what the thing is, you know, in that sense. And that sort of makes sense. You have to put a boundary on it that is a test. So when I used to actually lecture on the first years at St. Mary's, I did the module on field-based methods. So we talk about speed and agility, and it was nice. And you were leading the course at the time, and you gave me a lot of freedom to approach it in a way that I wanted to, from, you know, my experiences within sport. And that made it a very enjoyable thing to teach, because I've got quite a lot of freedom here to get across the ideas I want to get across. And I'd say to them, I don't know if I ever told you this, I said to them at the end of each lecture, I'd say, don't listen to anything I've told you. Like, just keep this in mind for when you're either coaching outside of here, or when you get to the end of your degree and you go and coach, because nothing I've said to you is based on the boxes as they're framed are specific for this course, because I'm not connected to that. I don't understand what those boxes are in order to be able to deliver that to you. Now, I'm just telling you how I approach it within sport, and here's some frameworks and here's the thinking, and this is how we do acceleration and so on and so on. But you have to understand the boxes that you're being evaluated on. And the game of university is to get the best score you can in those boxes. And it's just understanding that's what university is. It's not the whole thing. You're not going to come out and be able to coach like really well, because you've just done a tiny little bit of coaching over a few years. Like if you get in your first year and you start coaching with a team and get as much coaching experience as you can, at the end of 3 years, you're going to be really, really good coach, because you've done 3 solid years of coaching alongside the structure of an education and giving you the foundations of understanding physiology and mechanics and like periodization processes. And you need to understand that structure and that those pieces. But then you take those static ideas into the world of your experience as a coach, and you face that openly. So this links very nicely to the subject of the episode in a nice circular way. But you need both. Like the value of having that for me was, even though my nature is always to go, why is that the way? And something like that, you need that to bump up again, going, this is what physiology and years, like tens of decades and decades of physiology and scientific understanding, this is what this at this stage believes, and this is how it's being explained at the moment. You need to take these static ideas and then face the chaos of an athlete trying to get better at their sport. But the way you get really good at solving problems with athletes and teams is spending time solving problems with athletes and teams. But you need both. And I think that's something that I think young coaches maybe don't get. Maybe they've not bumped into the problem of that yet, because in university, unless you go out and coach, you're not going to bump into that problem until after you come out of the university. And I know that St. Mary's does this, and I know that a lot of university courses will be encouraging the student, go out and coach, and then some of them will, some of them won't. But until you bump into the problem of that stuff, doesn't really help me out here in the way I thought it would, because it's a messier problem. And that's just the reality of it. It's always going to be a messy problem. But the static structures give us some tools to help solve that. And that's the point, really. I think in universities, the best thing is like recognizing that role that they play in communicating almost like historical understanding. And then the rest of it is done in actual real, coaching. So you're going to have to go and coach. If you want to be a coach, you're going to have to coach. And then going back to just solving those problems, is like the best way to get better at something is to do that thing. That is the best way. But there's only so much of certain things you can do. Like rugby, for example, you can't crash into each other in 15v15 every single day. Although in theory, it'd be quite a good way of getting better at crashing into each other in 15v15. So then you have like derivatives of that make up the training. It might be non-contact ball pitch, and then it might be certain scenarios that you start to break down, and tactically you start to unpiece the whole thing. But I find it fascinating some places how little of the 15v15 problems they actually solve, because they're so focused on trying to do all the different bits of it. They only ever put it together on a weekend. And then that's great if you've just played 80 minutes. But if you was on the bench and you played 5 minutes and you had no time of solving the problem of 15v15, and then all of a sudden 6 weeks go by and you've not really had much, and then you've got to go back and solve the problem. And the coach gets angry at them because they can't solve the problem. But it's like they've not faced that problem for yeah. weeks and weeks and weeks. And that's the sidetrack a little bit, but that's a bit in something you see in pro sport, I think, as well.
Mm. Just as a final question for our listeners, could you recommend 3 books for anyone that wants to learn more about creativity or three books that you've particularly enjoyed and helped you determine your thought process around creativity?
Yeah, definitely. Number one is Free Play by Stephen Nachmanovich. It's probably one of my favorite books. That's the one I think that best displays that dichotomy between repetition and exploration, which is how we learn skills. This balance between repetition and exploration. And he does it in the context of music. It's a wonderful book. I've just enjoyed reading it so much. And I think it put together a few pieces of ideas that I've been thinking about and sort of read it at the perfect time. So everyone should read that, I think. Another one that I think is good in this subject is Messy by Tim Hartford, which was brilliant for me at a time where I was getting in organizations and recognizing that I maybe thought slightly differently towards how they were going with things. And it loads and loads of examples within that book on how this messy, almost like explorative bumping it, you got to give yourself space to bump into things. And that's a really important part of development. And what we want really in terms of learning, again, going back to that balance, is this almost like slightly step-by-step progressive bit. And then we also want this, allow yourself to go and mess and bump into things. And he's got loads and loads of examples in there of like how great athletes have done that and great companies and how they allow space to bump into new ideas, essentially. So this balance between structural progression and update, that's a great book for that. Probably the one of my favorite books that I read, this sparked a lot of, I realized later in life, this sparked a lot of my interest in where I went with my life. It's about Bruce Lee. It's a biography on Bruce Lee. It's called Fighting Spirit. It's by Bruce Thomas, who was a guitarist. I've done you well with these recommendations.
I know. I don't actually have Messy. For anyone watching on YouTube, you can see me putting up the books on screen. But if you're just listening, I've done that for Bruce Lee and I've done that for Free Play, but I've not read Messy. But it was you that introduced me to the Bruce Lee book. So I was hoping you'd choose this one.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. Well, it's basically about like, it talks about mastery and how Bruce Lee approached it. But it's written by Bruce Thomas, who was a guitarist for Eric Clapton. So he was a master of the guitar. He's writing a book about Bruce Lee and how he approached martial arts from a perspective of mastery. And I think I first read it when I was like 14 on holiday. And I didn't realize until I reread it when I was like 28, 29, how much of my life had probably been influenced by ideas within that book. And like thinkers that I'd come across late, much later in life that were mentioned in that book. And they probably set me off as well on this little, they were partly on sport and training, but also on philosophy. And I'm going to sneak another sort of book in here. One of the people he speaks about in there is Krishnamurti. His whole thing was around like, you know, question everything all the time, make your own opinion up on everything. And, you know, you've got to face everything with that openness. I think I read that as like a somewhat rebellious 17-year-old, 16-year-old maybe, the Krishnamurti stuff. Think on these things is one. Freedom from the known was the other. I didn't need that influence of that rebellious time of my life. Of like, it basically, one of them starts off as like, don't listen to your teachers. Don't listen to your parents. You know, it's like his whole point is you have to face everything as it is in front of you. Keep open to that all the time. And that cycles back nicely to being some of the stuff we started off with on creativity. And then if anything, maybe that's a perfect summary of it, is to face everything in front of you exactly as it is and be open to exactly everything, all that it is. And if you are approaching things with a framework, understand it's just a framework and it's not the whole thing. And then maybe you'll be able to find the necessary way to solve that problem in front of you at that time.
All right, Tom, amazing choices. And I'm glad you chose those because they've been highly influential for me as well. Funnily enough, I read them because you recommended them to me. So hopefully people listening will read them as well and find them just as influential for them. So thank you for that. And mate, it's been perfect. And we'll get round two booked in.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you very much for having me, mate. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, class. Cheers. Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.